Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Darwin Cook became interested in economic engineering while he was in college after taking a disappointing course in Economics 101. He realized that economics was a study of opinions that had no cohesive guiding principles like other sciences he had studied and used for engineering. He considered changing his major to economics, but stayed with his first love, engineering, and got a master's degree in electrical engineering. In 2009, Darwin Cook retired, bought a sailboat, and began sailing the Caribbean, a lifestyle that gave him time to put a lifetime of economic thoughts down in a book. From Profits to Prosperity, Blueprint for a Democratic Humanistic Economy. The theme in this book is the economy is yours. You don't need a savior and you don't need permission. Darwin Cook, welcome.
It's good to be here. I'm excited about this subject. It's fascinating for me.
You must be, because you spent a lot of time writing this book. And you were an electrical engineer, and when you took that econ course in college, what did you think about it?
I was, disappointed, but enthusiastic in a negative way, unfortunately, which is that I just couldn't understand why economics would be based on just a bunch of opinions instead of rules that you could read and say, well, of course, that has to be true, and that has to be true, and that has to be true. No, there's no rules in economics, they say. And, of course, to me, there have to be rules in order to achieve good economics for the vast majority of humanity. No wonder we're getting a raw deal if we have no principles on which to go by.
Well, your title, From Profits to Prosperity, and you say who gets the profits and who needs the prosperity.
Exactly.
Well, now, you say it's a blueprint for a democratic, humanistic economy. We may have some idea of what democratic is, but humanistic, what do you mean, Darren?
By humanistic, I mean that at the very meta-economic level, in other words, above economics, the guiding principles of economics have to focus on what is compatible with humanity. Economics must serve humanity. This economics we have, it's the other way around. We serve the economic system. They tell us what has to be the way, the rules of the game, so to speak, that they come up with in an ad hoc fashion. So the idea of humanism is that humanistic ideas should guide economics.
Well, you say in your book, a humanistic economic system is intended to serve the majority of humanity rather than have the majority of humanity serve the economic system. Humanism intends to expand the conventional concept of democracy to include matters of the economy as well as embodied in, and then you have this economic bill of rights that you propose.
Yes.
And then you suggest we form an economic control authority.
Exactly.
And you say that you believe most, if not all, our goals can be achieved, these goals that you set forth, by expanding the scope of the Federal Reserve System into an independent economic control authority that you call the ECA.
Right. The current system we have already is independent, or was intended to be. I think we could even improve that a little if we were rewriting that legislation. I think they could do better. But that's probably true of all legislation. So, of course, it should be independent, and we're amazed at how independent it actually is right now already. What I wanted to do is to expand the scope of what they can do and what goals they can have. Right now, the Federal Reserve is very restricted. They can basically do one thing, only one thing, manipulate interest rates. That's all. The only knob they have to control the world is this one little control. Furthermore, they can only look at two items, and they mostly look at inflation. They're supposed to also kind of keep in mind unemployment. shouldn't be so high as to cause people to go out in the street and demonstrate, right? But they really don't put that very high as compared to inflation. So they have only one goal, inflation management, you might say. I'm proposing expanding the role substantially, and I can go into more detail if you'd like.
Well, you say that capitalism and its wealth economics have not been challenged for 100 years. Because what you're saying pretty much is we just accept, well, this is the way things are. They've always been this way. And here you come along, Darwin, and say, but no, they don't have to always be this way.
Indeed, I'm trying to motivate my fellow man to realize that we need to get involved and we need to define what we expect from economics in a human way and make economics do what we want, what's good for us, instead of the other way around. And that's such a change in idea, in attitude, that it's literally on the level of a renaissance in economic thinking.
The title of your book is From Profits to Prosperity. And you say if we can make this transition to prosperity economics, you say it'll double our prosperity for each of the next three generations and more.
Absolutely, yeah, one more. The actual calculations are go into one of the later chapters a little more. And the first generation would be closer to triple, which would be 200%. That's a huge difference over our lifetimes, even though it's a small percentage per year. You know, it's 1.5, maybe 2% a year more to humanity. But boy, when you compound it over a lifetime and then hand it on to your children, look what a difference you give to your children. I think this is something we should give some thought to.
My guest is Darwin Cook, and he is a retired electrical engineer who was always interested in economics, and he has written a book, From Profits to Prosperity. But you know what? Now, you're saying you're bringing a scientific approach because economics, as you were taught in college, was opinions. But then some of your readers, Darwin, are they saying, you're writing science fiction, Darwin?
Well, yes. Most people become interested and then they become cautious. That's the reaction I'm most familiar with. They become cautious because it seems as if they don't want to believe in something like that because they'll be disappointed. They see a pretty ugly world, basically. They see a cruel, inhumane kind of economics, and that is the kind of economics I'm reacting to as well. I'm trying to do something about that. But they see that cruel, inhumane kind of approach to economics that, in fact, Keynes, the great John Maynard Keynes, realized and wrote an essay about, in which he says, basically, foul is fair and fair is foul in economics, and that it has to be that way for another 100 years. And he wrote that in 1931. So he was in tune with the problem, but he wasn't very in tune with the solution. He was basically saying it's got to be ugly. And haven't we all been told the same thing? And not even those of us who have never taken an economics class, we're really basically told economics is supposed to be ugly. And we, the cheap economists, are in charge of this ugly. I'm proposing a different approach than ugly. That's, after all, the way we do electrical engineering, the way we do iPhones, is we don't start out with ugly. We have principles that work. Maxwell's equations works. The law of gravity works. Well, economics is a human science, so we can't look at this exactly the same way, but almost.
Well, you say you dedicate your book to the middle 80% of all of humanity, and in particular to the middle 80% of humanity in our country, the United States. And you say we have been exploited and lied to. But do we know that we have been? I think that's the danger.
I wonder. I think a lot of people do. They just don't want to, I guess, admit it. They don't want to accept the fact. They think, gee, maybe if I work long enough, I'll get to be in charge of ugly too. You know, right now, ugly isn't working for me, but maybe if I just worked harder, ugly would work later on, and I'd get a piece of the big hunk of the greed.
The profits.
See, the profits, yeah. You know? But we never do. Almost none of us do. We can count, after all. We can go out there and count all those rich people, and they're just a tiny fraction of humanity. Yeah, it's such a small fraction.
And that's why you're saying it's time for an economic renaissance to show us a path of greater prosperity, a solution that will make you a principal of the economy instead of its subject.
Exactly.
And that's what you're saying.
And that is sort of what our forefathers did regarding political democracy. They envisioned a system in which we define the rights and the freedoms proactively. Now, we don't wait for the king to tell us how much our share is this year. You see what I'm saying? Right? And that's that's what we rebelled against. But in economics, we still have a feudal authority.
And then, Darwin, things don't come from the bottom up. We don't have any power. We have to wait till the upper echelon tells us what we can do. And you say, no, that's not the case.
I think that's not the case. I think we don't know what to do, and they keep us stupid. You see what I'm saying? I don't think it's actually a lack of power when we come right down to it, although I understand that powerless feeling, and I have it as well as everyone else. But I don't think what we're missing, we're missing a blueprint that says these are the five rules of economics. And this is the rules that humanity in the United States want to play by. And if you want to play by our rules, fine. Otherwise, we're going to determine it. It's a democracy.
My guest is Darwin Cook. He is an electrical engineer by profession, but by avocation, an economist. His book is From Profits to Prosperity, Blueprint for a Democratic Humanistic Economy. And people might not be following what you're saying. Well, Darwin, that doesn't have much to do with me. Until, this is just my opinion now. When they get to what you're titling these titles, you've numbered them, title 18, tax, because this is the way we control things to get them to do what we want to do. We levy taxes. Tax excessive sales, marketing, and advertising. And boy, I could feel my blood pressure go up just reading that, Darwin. You say the prosperity mandate fundamentally changes our conception of good business practices. Advertising, marketing, and sales costs are areas of particular concern. These are examples of costs that the business community is convinced that are necessary or desirable to improve their businesses or more likely to satisfy their shareholders and make their bonuses. Much of these costs are defensive in that they are motivated by a desire to match their competitors. So the good guys who say, I'm not going to have a huge budget to advertise, is sitting there and all his competitors are advertising like crazy.
Well, let's look at the reason I chose that. I actually, in a number of chapters there, do the same thing of saying, let's take this concept of humanism, this prosperity-oriented capitalism. That's what I'm really proposing, not to change capitalism, but to change the paradigm of profits versus prosperity. So as soon as we have a set of axioms that guide us to prosperity instead of profitability, we look at things differently. And I picked this one because it gets everybody. You know, said, what do you mean? Isn't advertising good? No, it's easy to analyze. Advertising is a cost. If you advertise your automobile, does that make the car more valuable? No, of course not. It can't. Not one penny more valuable.
Yet, but you spent a lot of
money. You have this guy, very highly paid, highly commissioned person, telling you all about the car. He costs about $2,000 to buy a car. He gets $2,000 of it. What value does he add to that car? Zero. Now, we know this. When we reason this, we see this. But the problem is that businesses do what businesses think are going to give them the greatest profits. We need to come up with a set of rules, and in fact, I proposed them, five simple axioms that we would go by that would direct us towards prosperity. And from a prosperity point of view, that extra salesman's cost to that car is not creating a value added. And we would increase our efficiency, and then I could spend more. That other $2,000 I could spend on products in the local community that would benefit the rest of humanity.
And then here's one now that is everywhere. You can't pick up your phone without some intrusive ad.
Yes.
To make matters worse, pesky sales personnel and intrusive advertising are not welcome advancements to the quality of life or the common good of the vast majority. Just driving down the highway, I'm assaulted by billboards that I wish I'd rather see countryside. And yet these advertisements assault us. You say, in short, the consumers are forced to pay for what offends them, and I'm highly offended by these ads, and does not benefit them. They don't benefit me, and yet I am paying for them, in a way, to be offended. You say, consequently, sales costs in excess of mere customer support and advertising and marketing outside the storefront or business website will be taxed. So under your system, you're going to tax the advertising that is outside the storefront or the business website.
Exactly. See, the heart of the problem that we're talking about here, in a way, is this false slogan of wealth economics that tells us that whatever's good for business is good for the economy. And it's a lie. We know it's a lie, didn't we? I do. And I certainly described the lie in the book. So here's the quandary then. The business says, yeah, but I can maximize profits if I advertise. I don't care about having a better economy. I care about what's good for my business. And after all, what's good for business is good for the economy. What a slogan.
I thought you might quote that old saw, what's good for General Motors is good for the country.
Yes, exactly. That's another variation of the same thing.
Yeah. My guest is retired electrical engineer Darwin Cook, who has written a book about economics. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Darwin Cook. He is an electrical engineer by training, but he's interested in economics, and that's the topic in his book, From Profits to Prosperity. You dedicate your book to painting a clear picture of what we must do and how we can do it, but it seems so overwhelming.
It does, and I certainly hope, I think when you read forward more towards the end, that I acknowledge the overwhelming feelings and kind of tell us what we can do about that overwhelming feeling. But a lot of the reason that it seems so overwhelming is that we've kind of been brainwashed from childhood almost, certainly from grade school, that you better watch out. You better not shout. You know, you better be careful because you could lose your job at any moment. We have been threatened. And that kind of threat affects, you can see how that affects children. Well, it affects adults too. I'm retired now and I feel a little bit independent. But when I had a family to be worried about and college educations to face up to, and they told me, you better do this because it'll create more jobs. I believed, I didn't want to lose my job. Nobody I knew wanted to lose their job. We've been threatened, and that kind of intimidates me and makes me angry. I mean, economic thoughts based on intimidation, that sounds to me like an angry kind of situation.
Well, I'll tell you something else that made me angry was your chart, the ratio of CEO to worker pay. In 1950, it was 20 to 1. Now, that's a lot to me.
Yeah.
1950, CEOs earned 20 times as much as a worker. 1980, it more than doubled, 42 to 1. By 2000, it was 120 to 1. I kept going down. 2013, 2016, 347 to 1 was the ratio of a CEO's pay to a worker's pay. That's unconscionable.
It's absolutely infuriating, isn't it? And yet, who's going to do anything about this? Now, we have politicians. Let's look at this one, and let's look at this in detail, because here's a case where we kind of blame the politicians. But I want to make it clear that in my book, I blame the economists. They're the ones who are supposed to represent us. Of course, the politicians are sleazy and lie to us. I mean, what else is new? The real issue is that the economists didn't come along and create and say, look, I mean, it doesn't have to be this way. Let's have some controls on this. There's nothing. It's like it doesn't matter. Whatever it is this year, it should double next year.
Well, another thing that you mentioned that also gets most of us rather upset, and this is one of the topics you cover, tax excessive legal costs. So again, we're taxing. That's a way of our controlling our values. Excessive legal costs are an issue as well because they reduce efficiency. Consequently, excessive legal costs in your system would be taxed.
Absolutely.
So we might want to point a finger at lawyers. They are always a good target for our ire.
Not only the lawyers tend to legalize things, but many businesses, I can give you an example, many businesses kind of thrive on excessive legal costs. For example, remember the condo era where there were everybody
flipping.
Was selling condos in foreign countries, and you could have your own share of this business, and you'd own condos every place, and you could go to vacations, and those were marketed in such an abusive way. I mean, they got you in a room and they wouldn't let you out until you created this agreement. And they had 100 different techniques and they just went from one technique to another. Very high pressure marketing. And then, of course, most people tried to back out, so there were nothing but lawsuits. Well, of course, they had to add, they made the condo very expensive because of adding all these legal costs that did nothing for the product, adding all these sales costs that did nothing for the product. They're just very inefficient and they prey on us.
My guest is Darwin Cook. He is a retired electrical engineer whose avocation was economics ever since he took an Econ 101 class in college. And his book is From Profits to Prosperity, Blueprint for a Democratic Humanistic Economy. And one point you make in your book is that nobody is in charge. You say, who's in charge of our economy? Who's in charge of our prosperity? Who's in charge of productivity? Who's in charge of national income? Who's in charge of the distribution of income and wealth? Who establishes our national economic goals and monitors and manages their achievement? Boy.
Well, see, that's the change that I'm recommending. Two parts. One, a new set of rules. So we have to be armed with principles that are undeniable. Rules of economics that can't be defied. It can't be denied. It can only be defied.
Can't be argued with.
They're unarguable. Like, for example, the principle of which our government was based originally, of the democracy, that all men are created equal. We need rules like that. And I propose 5 or 6 in the book. Once we have those rules, though, they don't do anything for us unless we have a NASA-like organization that's going to carry out the rules, that's going to follow the rules and police them and make sure they're achieved and measure them. That is this ECA that I described, which is really just an expanded version of our central bank that we already have. So it's not so unrealistic to improve the central bank function, the Fed, that we have to execute these rules.
And I'm going to remind listeners that ECA stands for Economic Control Authority. And you refer to it as ECA, and it would be independent.
it would be under control of Congress, but independent the way it is now, so that it can tell Congress whatever it thinks is the way it is. In other words, it's charged with a certain charter. It said, you're responsible for doing this, and then we're going to leave you alone. We might ask you questions about why you did this, why you did that. Occasionally, the head of the Federal Reserve has to go over to Congress, I think it's every quarter, and kind of give them a little report, and they get to ask him questions. But basically, if he decides we need a little more interest or a little less interest, they make the decision. They don't have to account to Congress for every decision they make. So that's the kind of independent power I'm talking about, something we've already tried, but we only apply it to inflation. Let's apply it to these five rules instead.
Well, maybe one sidelight, if our economy continues to get worse, that people will be more interested in looking around for ideas like yours, Darwin. They're going to say, gosh, what can we do? And you have a plan.
I think the time has come for this. And I sense, not with total joy, that there is this big bubble that I talk about in the book, this bubble of anger and frustration with an economic system that tends to prey on us instead of achieve for us. I mean, it's a complete opposite from what we might expect to what we actually have. I think, you see the Yellow Jacket movement now. I mean, there's been, remember the Occupy Wall Street movement? There is a built-up resentment and anger about this mistreatment. And I hope we can make that pop without dire consequences, because I think if we don't start to make changes, that there will be a response, and it won't be organized. It won't be towards some constructive plan. It'll just be burning stuff in the street. That's not what we want. So we need to see that now and try to make changes before the bubble pops.
So what you're proposing is a path from profits for the privileged to prosperity for all mankind.
Exactly.
Thank you, Darwin Cook.
Thank you.
Retired electrical engineer Darwin Cook's book is From Profits to Prosperity, Blueprint for a Democratic Humanistic Economy. We're going to take a break, and when I come back, I'll talk to anthropology professor Alice Waterston about a dramatic personal story, My Father's Wars. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Alice Waterston is a presidential scholar and professor of anthropology at City University of New York, John Jay College of Criminal Justice. In 2013, she published an ethnographic account of her father and a book called My Father's Wars. She visited Chico State University, Chico, at the invitation of Humanities and the Department of Comparative Religion to explore a dramatic personal story, part memoir and part social history, which raises important questions about the dramatic forces of history, the experience of exile and immigration, the legacies of culture, and the enduring power of memory. Alice Waterston, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I'm curious about the name Waterston, because I suspect that this was anglicized somewhere in your family history.
That's true. Yes, my father was born Menachem Mendel Wasserstein on the eve of World War I. And he went by the name Mendeley, which is the diminutive, the Yiddish diminutive of Mendel. And his story that I recount in My Father's Wars takes us across continents and cultures and countries and language groups. And my father's name changes reflect his migration trajectory. So he started out as Mendeley, and then when he landed in Cuba, he became Miguelito. And at a certain point in his journey, he joined the U.S. military during World War II. And that's when he changed his name again to Michael Waterston. So from Wasserstein to Waterston.
And then that became your name.
That became my name. And I've kept it all these years.
All these years. So where was your dad? Where did he grow up?
So he grew up in this little town right on the eve of World War I. And it was in the part of Poland that was sort of slapped around back and forth between the Germans and the Russians and many empires.
My guest is Elise Waterston, and she is a professor of anthropology, but she has written a book about her own father entitled My Father's Wars. And you were saying your dad grew up in this part of Poland and that he was willing to tell stories. You know why that surprises me a little bit? Because a lot of it was pretty horrific.
Yes, it's interesting. My father was a talker and a storyteller, which is unusual because a lot of times with stories of family past that have horrific aspects to it, there's a lot of silence. And as I've given presentations on my father's wars, I hear from people about the silences in their own families and of their interest in trying to dig a little deeper to find out, gee, what was my family background like? What was my family history about? So in that way, I was very fortunate because he was a storyteller. However, my father also, because he was my father, always had a message or a lesson for his children when he told stories. So I had to be very careful when I approached him, not simply as a daughter, but as an anthropologist, which is what this project really is about. I had to be very, very careful about listening attentively to what he was saying, to kind of tease out when he was trying to give me a lesson about life and about, things he wanted me to do or not to do. And also how I could push him from the pat narratives that he tended to convey over and over again. And I had to listen carefully so that I could also interpret them. So, for example, he always told the war story over and over again. When he was just a toddler, it was World War I. And as I said before, he was born on the eve of World War I. And that was a very horrific part of his life. War wasn't a backdrop, but it was core to his experience. And he repeated that story so often it would get irritating after a while. But then I realized that there was meaning to it. And the meaning is it has to do with the trauma that he experienced at such a tender age. And he did live throughout the rest of his life with this sense of fear and a sense of having to run away and the sense of having to hide. And I think, in part, I don't want to reduce anything to one series of events, in early childhood. But part of the point of my book is to look at all of the different contexts in the many places that he lived over the course of the 20th century, which was a very violent century.
And obviously, we know, because you mentioned your dad went to Cuba, mm-hmm. that there was immigration, there was exile. So when he was just a toddler, he is faced with what war is like. And in this war, who for him were the good guys and the bad guys?
Well, I think, you know, the way he recounts the story is, you know, on the streets of Yevgrodno, the Germans and the Russians were fighting one another. And he said, and he would say, in those years, the Germans were good to the Jews. The Russians were not so good to the Jews. But what happened after World War I was the establishment of the Polish state. And my grandmother had made the decision that she did not want any of her sons to be drafted into the Polish army. And so she wanted to send them out of the country, and she wanted them to go to the United States. So her second born, his name was Muttel, who later became Manolo. But Muttel, he ventured out from Poland to get to the United States just in time for the 1924 immigration law, which was a racialized law rooted in theories of eugenics. And some of the political rhetoric is, you know, it was really awful. And they didn't want, the U.S. at that time did not want riffraff like those who came from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe into the country. And so Muttel was one of the riffraff and couldn't get into the United States. And so he landed in Havana instead. And in fact, he worked as a construction worker to build the Capitol building in Havana, which is modeled after the U.S. Capitol building.
Well, you know, I have heard that we all know how terrible the Germans were to the Jews, but I have read from people who grew up there that they really dreaded the Russians more than the Germans. And that's what your dad confirmed.
Well, I think what's important is that every particular moment in history is part of the context. So we can't, part of my point in this book and what my experience was in doing the research with him, but also among Polish Catholics in Poland at a certain point in this project, is that we can't make global statements like my father did. You know, the Russians were good, the Germans were bad, the Poles are this. My father would say Poles are all anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. And I came to learn in the course of doing this project that those are very dangerous statements, even if they come from a perspective, from an experiential perspective. But the problem is when we homogenize whole groups of people or whole nation states, and we fail to look at what is going on at any particular moment in time, because that's where the history comes in, and that's where the larger, what I would call political economy, what is going on with the power dynamics, what is going on with the social relations between the ethnic groups, between the religious groups, between the racialized groups, between the nation-state groups, in amidst imperial war, for example, in the story of that part of the world, that actually shape the dynamics and relationships between the groups in those places, so that there was, at different historical moments, cooperation. And then at other times, there was terrible divisiveness. But those feelings and attitudes must be understood in that larger context. That's the challenge. And that's the challenge for us today.
My guest is anthropology professor Elise Waterston, and she has written a book, My Father's Wars. Her father came from Poland and a large family, what mm-hmm. we would consider a large family. How many members of his family?
Oh, dear. There were seven. There were seven siblings. Mm-hmm.
So he makes his way to Havana.
First Muttel, and then when he made a little money, then he brought the other one, and then he brought the other one, and then he brought the other one. And the last ones to arrive were in 1939. And that was my father's parents. But my father arrived in 1930. And they were in what my father would call shtetl, a small town. But of course, in the Cuban context, it's not a shtetl. But just this town called Manguito, which is in the province of Matanzas. And they set up a shop there, a dry goods shop, in the middle of a sugar plantation economy region. They thought they would be able to make a fortune there, but actually the industry, here's another part of the context, the sugar industry there was dying out and was in another part of Cuba, had moved elsewhere. So they were small shopkeepers until they moved to Havana.
Well, your experience, your dad's experience, reminds me of a friend I had who was a professor here in the United States, but she had had to leave her native homeland of Cuba, and she was Jewish, and she said in her dreams she goes back to her home in Cuba and walks through the house. And I wonder if her family history somehow paralleled your family history.
I am sure that it did, because it depends on, you know, when her family arrived in Cuba, but there were many, well, not many, but, 10,000, 7,000, 8,000 Jews who came to Cuba, in that period, in the post-1924 period. And there is a, there was a large, a relatively, you know, solid Jewish community in Havana and in other parts of Cuba as well. And there were many of them are in Miami now and comprise a relatively large Jewish community in Miami.
Well, so your dad goes first to Cuba in the New World. And how does he make his way to the United States?
From Manguito, he went to Havana. And that's where he and his brothers opened stores. We like to call them shmata stores. A shmata is a Yiddish word for a rag. But of course, they didn't really sell rags. They were trying to sell fabric and menswear and women's wear. And that's what they did. The brothers each had their own shops. And at one point, my father had two. He did join the U.S. military, so that in part because he wanted to become a U.S. citizen. That was one of his strategies. He made his way to New York prior to joining the military, the U.S. military, on shopping excursions to Manhattan, where he bought items wholesale for his stores in Havana. He met my mother in New York, and then he established a family, our family, in New York while he had business in Cuba. And so he commuted. He'd spent a couple of months in New York and a few months in Cuba. And as a child in the 1950s, I would go to Cuba with the family for over the Christmas holiday and over the summer vacations until the revolution.
And that's how a lot of us have Cuban friends, because I was close to Florida, which is where they first came. And so here we start to get our own history intertwined, the U.S. that your dad became a part of, marries your mother, and then how did he tie up the loose ends from Cuba?
So this is it's a long, drawn out, and complicated story, but to try to give you an abbreviated version, when the revolution in Cuba happened, you know, things were not necessarily, suddenly black and white, everything, went from, everything was nationalized. That wasn't true. There was a longer process, which has to do, again, with larger political dynamics that I do discuss in the book. The way it affected my father personally was that he, originally, when the revolution occurred, he welcomed the new revolutionary government because Batista was terrible. Batista was our man in Havana, meaning the U.S.'s man in Havana. But my father really suffered under Batista just in terms of trying to run a business and having to deal with all the graft and so forth. So in the beginning, the companies that were nationalized were large corporations and not small little stores like my father's. But over time, things changed, and it became more and more difficult for my father to extract any money from the stores, from his businesses, to support his family in New York. That he was able to pay workers, but the owners of the stores could not take out any money. So that became really very. It was a very stressful time in our household, and my mother had to start making sewing dresses and selling them to neighbors, and she had to borrow money from neighbors to buy groceries. And then after a while, he lost everything. He had all his money in Cuban banks, and he borrowed money from friends, and went to manufacturers who he bought merchandise from, and he begged them to allow him to buy merchandise on credit. And he started all over again in Puerto Rico. And that's where my father went from Michael Waterston and Miguel Waterston in Cuba to Don Miguel in Old San Juan, Puerto Rico.
And how old were you at this time?
So we moved to Puerto Rico when I was, so it was 1964. So I was 13 years old at the time. For me, it was a wonderful adventure, but to move from New York to Puerto Rico.
So you considered it an adventure, and all this time you would ask your dad about stories from his childhood and adulthood.
I did. In fact, in Puerto Rico, in high school we took Latin American history. So when the point, in the course was about Cuban history, I would go to my father and say, "So, wait, when this dictator was in power, where were you? And when this happened, where were you?" And so he would tell wonderful anecdotes about those times.
So you had a curiosity about this from the time you were quite young. And when you were at the age of deciding what you were going to study as a college student, did you have any idea that you would weave this interest you have in anthropology with your own family history?
So I love that question. Thank you for it. So I have a funny story. So as an undergraduate, I majored in psychology. I did not major in anthropology. And I was a school teacher in Brooklyn, New York, when I graduated college. And I discovered anthropology at a later point in my late 20s and went to graduate school after that, which was very unusual. and I followed my heart, let's put it that way. So, and my work in anthropology has been focused on the displaced and dispossessed. I've written a book on women and homelessness in New York. I've written a book about street drug addicts in the mid-80s. And I've also done work on war. I have a book.
Yes, I didn't mention, but this is not your first book by any means. You've written a lot of books prior to My Father's Wars.
Right. So, and at a certain point, I felt that I wanted to do this story. I wanted to approach my father as a daughter anthropologist and go back to his stories, but really find a way to contextualize it from my understanding as an anthropologist. And in an earlier iteration of this project, I had published a couple of articles in academic journals about this. And in one of them, I talk about how I came to realize that my father's experiences of displacement and dehumanization and exile really is the source for my interest in the displaced and the homeless and so forth. Later, more recently, I thought I came to this at that point in my life, but I didn't, because I found in an old file cabinet in my basement a piece of paper in a file when I was in my 20s, and I wrote down that I wanted to write a book about my father, and here is the table of contents. And I had no memory that I did that in my 20s before I even came to anthropology. I still think it's true that my interest in the displaced and dispossessed and dehumanized is centered in his sorrowful story, but it's also a story of resilience and adaptation and human spirit. It also is a story about culture and the ways in which certain structures, whether these be patriarchal or, economic structures, really shape and frame each of our understandings of the world. So my father, for example, was not a very easy person to get along with, and he was the patriarch in our household. And so, you know, there were all of those elements that you have the personal story, you have the man as a human being, you have the history, and you have all these larger social forces that come into play in this tangle that I tried to sort out and convey in a story that I title My Father's Wars, Migration, Memory, and the Violence of a Century.
And that's the title of Elise Waterston's book. She is a professor of anthropology at City University of New York, John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And this is not her first book, but she published this ethnographic account of her father in this book, My Father's Wars. And for those of us who don't have such a colorful family history, what would you like for us to learn from your book, Elise?
So I think that one of the things that I learned myself from this book that I would like others to learn is that we need to figure out a way to transcend the wounds that we all may feel, that we have, you know, on the level of the individual, but also on the level of the groups that I listed out before, the racialized group, the ethnic groups, the religious groups, the nation state groups. We hear daily, you know, political rhetoric that divides us, and it gets reinforced and reproduced. And this divisiveness is so destructive. And if we think about the world today, it's filled with violence. Even as there is light, because there is love and there is human spirit and there is humanity, but there is dreadful violence that must be addressed. And I think that one message of this book is that it tells a story about how we might imagine transcending the impasses and get beyond the violences if we can come to understand one another. And we can come to understand one another in part through stories like this one. And I do believe that everybody has painful history, even if they have beautiful history in their pasts.
Well, thank you so much for writing this book, Elise.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Elise Waterston. She is a professor of anthropology, has written numerous books. Her most recent is My Father's Wars. I'd also like to thank my first guest, retired electrical engineer Darwin Cook, who has written a book, From Profits to Prosperity.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.